I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Miles Hunt. Miles Hunt of the Wonder Stuff, and it's an absolutely glorious chat. When I set out to start Off the Beaten Track, one of the people that was definitely on the top of the list to speak to was Miles. I've been a huge fan of his music for a long, long time, and it was a real joy to sit down and discuss records with him, and you're going to love it. Before we actually get on with that chat, just a few shout-outs quickly. A big thanks to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network, and a massive thanks to 76 for producing this podcast. And also, if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track, then can I suggest that you have a look in the archives when this episode's finished, because there's over 150 episodes now with some of your favourite musicians, DJs, comedians, actors. Go and have a rummage. You will find something that you like, I promise you. And if that's not enough, then I do also have a Patreon page. And over on there, I put up standalone episodes each week as well. And so you can go over there and access them. And by doing that, you also support the podcast. So you can find out about all of these things on www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. But let's get back to business. Today's episode, this gives me enormous pleasure to say, please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Miles Hunt. Listen up, I've only got another new sponsor, Eggfried. It's this super cool clothing label, and if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this. They have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Eggfried. Also, they've got a new kids range. And it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Hello, and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. And sitting opposite me via the means of Zoom is Miles Hunt. Hello.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Appreciate your time today, mate.
That's all right. Thanks for asking.
It's great. I'm really looking forward to this. I should point out, I don't know what your song choices are yet, so I'm excited to know what they are.
Okay.
But before we start, I just want to ask how you, Miles, have found the lockdown situation as Miles Hunt, the human being, and as Miles Hunt, the creative force.
Is that what I am? As a human being, I live on my own with my little dog, and I live very rurally. I'm not really a people person. I never was. And as I get older, I'm 54 next week, I am even less inclined to spend my time with the other humans. So being on my own and being in the middle of nowhere and going for days on end without speaking or interacting with other humans is quite normal for me. So I've been all right. Yeah. In fact, I think it's John Ronson, right at the beginning, the journalist John Ronson wrote a piece about people that suffer generally with anxiety were heading into the beginning of lockdown and seemingly handling it better than people that don't live with anxiety.
Yeah.
And it really rang true with me. I think he said something like, those of us with anxiety, it's as if we've been preparing for something like this all this time, and now we feel some sort of validation. So I didn't worry about it all. My parents are still with me, thank goodness, and they're 80 years old, both of them, in September. And so it was very easy for me to adapt the rules and regulations of lockdown because I like my parents being alive. They both have underlying health issues. And so, you know, I guess I'm 53, 54, you know, I could probably take on the virus if I cop for it myself and probably survive it, but I don't want to be responsible for the person that kills his parents was my sort of mantra. So as a human being, very easy. I was also a creative force?
Yeah.
As a creative force, I'm now going to, when I meet people for the first time, I'm going to hello, my name is Miles Hunt and I am a creative force.
Stick it on a CV, mate.
I was very, very fortunate for one of the very few times in my life I got my timing right. In so much as the Wonder Stuff released our last album around October last year and toured it throughout November and December last year, I had one gig I was supposed to do, an acoustic gig on my own in Amsterdam in March. So I lost that. That was part of the Shine Mini Cruise Festival. Mm-hmm. Because I'd actually earned some money at the end of last year, I wasn't wounded by losing my one booked gig. I felt the pain for the organizers and a lot of the other bands that had made their plans around it. I had very close friends, Ian Prowse of Pele and Amsterdam and now a solo artist. He was on tour with Elvis Costello and that tour got cut short. Another dear friend of mine, Luke Johnson, who I've known since he was a child, he's got a band called Low Lives, rocking band called Low Lives. They were out on tour in Europe when the lockdown came in, so they lost half a tour. So, I feel so fortunate that didn't happen, not just because it's my job and that's how I earn money, but, you know, you put a lot of preparation into a tour, physically and psychologically. So to be robbed of it for such a reason, it must have been really, really wounding for those people. I was very, very fortunate. This year, I'd planned to take off, really. There was some Wonder Stuff gigs booked festival-wise for September. But because I'd spent the last 2 or 3 years pretty intensively writing music mostly and demoing and recording, I didn't actually believe that my well was dry, but I thought there was probably a strong possibility that if I sat down to do some writing, there might not be anything left for a while. And I thought, okay, I'll take a year off rather than force something. And I didn't know whether that would be for the Wonder Stuff, whether it would be for a solo record, or as things have turned out, Event 414 record of some sort. So I was going to try and get my class 1 HGV driver's license. I love to drive. When I'm doing solo tours, I am essentially doing the job of a delivery driver, just delivering myself zigzagging around the UK. And I like, as I said before, I enjoy my own company. And so that was an idea I was toying with through January and February. I'd made a couple of calls to some friends that could point me in the right direction. And then lockdown happened, so I didn't get that done. So I did what I guess I'm supposed to be doing. I started writing. I reacquainted myself with Morgan Nichols, who had been the bass player in Vent 414 in the mid-90s. We hadn't seen each other since the end of the 90s.
The greatest bass player I've ever seen on stage.
It's ridiculous, isn't he?
Yeah.
I've stood in many a room and on many a stage with Morgan playing, and I have no understanding of what he's doing, yeah, how he's doing it. And what's really beautiful, I don't think Morgan does. I remember I used to be in rehearsal, sort of jam sessions with him and Pete Howard when we were doing Vent 414 in the 90s. And him and Peter get something going, and I'd, you know, every single time they'd start getting something going, I'm like, what the hell is this? This is fantastic. And I go, Morgan, what key is it in? And he would just sort of smirk at me and go, I don't know. So I always liked it that, you know, he's just so supremely talented, but with no ego about it. It's just what he does. He is one of the very few natural musicians that I've ever met. You know, it's not studies, it's just who he is. It's fantastic. So me and Morgan reacquainted at a Wonderstuff gig in December last year, and said he'd got some instrumental ideas he got kicking around, and he said, do you fancy putting your nasal whine on these and seeing if we can turn them into anything listenable? And Pete Howard was well up for it, because Pete Howard is now the drummer in the Wonderstuff. So when we got to lockdown, I thought, I'm gonna start writing a couple of songs in the style of Vent 414, whatever that is. And Morgan's got a home studio, I got a home studio. So I just started sending things to Morgan. And the very first thing we tried, I'm like, I actually got tearful when he sent me back the bass part for this song I'd written. It was just so great to hear that sound of his and hear how he plays. And so there was a great sense of nostalgia for me, but just like, what a beautiful place to end up, you know, in what none of us knew what 2020 was going to be at that point. And we've kept that going. So we throw ideas at each other every couple of weeks. Pete Howard, our drummer, Vent 414's drummer, is unable to record at home and he doesn't enjoy programming drums. So I got my friend Luke Johnson, who I mentioned earlier from the band Low Lives, knowing that he'd lost a tour. So he was at home in Arizona. And I know Luke's a great programmer. So I said, just to help me and Morgan along, would you program the drums? So Luke's been involved in that. I think we've got 6 or 7 Vent 414 ideas. And then again, when I asked Luke Johnson to do the programming for Vent 414, these are only demos, by the way. It'll be real drums when we finally get into a studio with Pete playing. Then Luke said he'd got a bunch of instrumentals he's been working on for a number of years and just said, do you fancy throwing your nasal whine on these as well? So I think I'm probably up to 7 or 8 tracks with Luke as well. I don't know. I mean, Luke comes from a sort of hard rock background, more hard rock than I do anyway. There's a couple of them that I might pluck up the courage to ask him if Vent 414 could have a shot at them. Or we might try and record them properly and Luke and I have a sort of partnership in that way for some sort of record or however you get music out to people in the modern world. So at the moment, you know, you can hear all this stuff. I've got a Bandcamp page where, because my I have an appalling attention span. It's really, really short. So where I don't mind admitting that when I finish a piece of music, I want instant gratification. And that usually is going to a studio, record it and plan to release a record, or sit or stand in front of an audience and play this new song. Yeah. And of course, I can do neither at the moment. So I thought I'd start making these demos available on a Bandcamp page. So if you look up Miles Hunt's Lockdown Demo Society, you can find all that stuff there.
Wonderful. Miles, am I right in saying, did Morgan have anything to do with Muse at any point?
Yeah, he's still very much involved. I think Muse kind of got their timing right as well, because they had a planned year off this year, which is why Morgan was available. So Morgan's been working with Muse, well over a decade.
Right, so this figures, right, because I went to the I live not too far from Chelmsford, so I went to the V Festival many years ago, and Muse come on. And something had happened to one of the relatives of the bass player, I believe.
Yeah,
and on like a week's notice, like I'm sure they said they've got their bass player on, and I was like right at the back, and I just thought, that's Morgan, I'm sure of it, and like, and I'm not a monster like Muse fan, but what I do know about Muse is it's quite complex sounding music, and to be able within a week to just jump up. And now that it's impressive. Yeah.
I think maybe at that point though, how long ago would you say that is?
Oh fuck, over 10 years ago, I reckon.
Okay, well that may have been his introduction to Muse. I don't know, but he does their keyboards and their programming. Looks after the kind of the tech stuff because he's on stage with them when they play. So they appear as a five piece.
Right.
I don't think he does any of the sort of promotional stuff. And Morgan always hated doing like videos and photograph sessions and all that. So I don't know whether that's a decision of Morgan's not to be involved in that or a decision of the band's. But either way, I know it will suit Morgan not to be having to be dragged into photo sessions and all that type of stuff. So he may have already been working with them. So Subliminal, he would have known all the arrangements. And then when that bass player needed a dep, Morgan's your guy,
Do you know what? Like, way back up, I run a venue in Essex and we had the Senseless Things play. And I have also never seen a drunker man walk on stage and knock it out the park like he'd driven there and was stone cold sober. It was unbelievable what was in the dressing room to what started playing a bass. I was like, oh my God, how's he doing that?
I know. The man's a mystery to me. I've never quite known anyone like him.
All right, let's get on with the playlist. Track one, Miles, can you tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please?
I can. I toyed with this one. When I was a kid, what I wanted to do in music was be a drummer. And I did that for probably the first 5 years of my gig in life until I found out that it's far too much of a responsibility being a band's drummer. And there's not enough showing off available to you. So I was going to go with 5 Years by David Bowie, just because of that beautiful faded in drum riff that I remember painstakingly learning that when I was a kid. But I wanted to, every single Wonder Stuff album. Oh, you see, now I've just thought, okay, I'm going to stick with the one. So what
I'm
going to say,
you can have an honorable mention, mate. It's all right.
Okay, all right. So I'm going to choose, because I heard this before, the one that I just thought of. And it taught me a lesson that every album should, or when I go in to make an album, you have a track that is very much the introduction to the album. It can never be a single. So with us, that's Red Berry Joy Tan and on the first album. And then you've got, the backwards guitar, the little Richard Burton vocal sample, Shakespearean vocal sample that then fades into Red Berry Joy Tan on Hop. You've got all the cut up TV and radio sampled stuff that we did. And then that kicks into 30 Years in the Bathroom on Neville. So there has to be.
What one was Never Loved Elvis? What one was it on there?
Well, Never Loved Elvis is Mission Drive.
Oh, but, of course it is.
Yeah, and that starts with sort of radio interference and a bit of I think there's a Hawkwind sample from Quark Strangeness and Charm in there as well. And then on the Fourth Wonder Stuff album, it's Change Every Light Bulb, and I created this character called the Reverend Hellacious Boom Boom and do this ridiculous sort of evangelical sort of preacher piss take thing. But the point being that you can't have track one as a single. It has to be a track that's going, hello and welcome to this new project. And then that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Track has to have an introduction in itself. And I think I believe this is true because of the Psychedelic Furs debut album and that introduction to the song India, which is John Ashton playing what I just thought was a bunch of random notes improvised, covered in delay and phase or a flange and effect. But one day, Malk Treese, the Wonderstuff guitarist, turned up at rehearsal and he played it. And it's it had never occurred to me that it was actually a piece of music. I thought it was this sort of improvised atmosphere. But of course, it is, you could score it out. It's a piece of music. And then it kicks into India, an amazing track itself, which has every signature that the Psychedelic Furs were at that, you know, that point in time. The heavy thundering tom-toms, all the flange guitars, that sort of nonchalance, Bowie-esque nonchalance in Richard Butler's voice. And then, do you know the movie Basquiat about the New York street artist?
I know, and the soundtrack to that album is one of my favourite soundtracks ever.
Right, okay. Well, there's a scene in one of the New York parks, and the music that they use is that introduction to India. And I've got, just thinking about it now, I've got shivers going down my arms. Yeah. I'll never forget when I saw that film, and I'm like, you know, you've got Basquiat walking through a park, and then there's this man. I'm like, what is it? Oh my God, they're using the intro to India. And it's so, and then I remember talking to Clint Mansell about it. We were on the phone a lot when we'd both seen, he was living in America, and we'd both seen Basquiat. And it was like, which one of them could say it sooner in the,
yeah.
Did you see Basquiat? What about India? Yeah. And it's so beautifully used. And ever since hearing that introduction to India, my mind is, every album needs some sort of atmospheric setup. My second choice would be, or as you said, my honorary mention, that does exactly the same job, would be This Is the Sea's opening track, Don't Bang the Drum by the Waterboys, that has that beautiful, you know, 16 pianos, the timing of the pianos is always 16s, and there's a trumpet, and then there's a hell of a drum fill into Don't Bang the Drum, and again, every hair on my body standing on end just thinking about it. So that would be the song with the greatest intro.
Very well answered there, Miles. So, I mean, you've nailed a fair few yourself, mate.
Right.
And so if we... I always ask musicians this on the podcast. When you write a song... how much emphasis do you put on an intro, and has that changed from Hup to when you write now because of the way that people listen to music now? Was radio a consideration back then? It's quite a loaded question here, Miles. But I'm just wondering how you know, you approach an intro, and how it's changed over the years in the way also people listen to music.
Well, with me, it hasn't changed at all. And I have no roadmap to writing a song at all. I employ what I would call a variety of tricks or little signatures of the way I write. When I'm writing, I never know what I'm writing. It's always looking, you know, into a darkened room and seeing what you can find. I often wished it wasn't so. I wished I did know how to approach songwriting. I don't. It's still a mystery to me. And perhaps that's why I still enjoy it so much, that I probably have as many fails as I do successes. You know, I have equally as many songs that I just give up on. I've never paid any attention to, you know, getting the vocal in the first 20 seconds, which something like Radio One would have liked when we first came along, or not having a minute of instrumental music before a vocal comes in. However, I like all sorts of different approaches to songwriting. So when we wrote something like Caught in My Shadow or A Wish Away, it didn't occur to us that both of those songs open with the chorus. It wasn't planned that way. It was just, that was probably whoever bought the song. Well, those two songs, it would have been me. But when I took those songs into the room with the band, I didn't play them a verse first. I played them a chorus first. Or it might well have been all I'd got was the chorus. And then I'd say, well, let's just kick that around and then look out to the rest of the guys in the band and say, anyone got anything to follow it? So there are absolutely no rules. No, I wouldn't pay the blindest bit of attention to what is the current way that people consume music. Not interested. And I'm only really ever writing for myself.
Yeah.
You know, first and foremost, I'm trying to please myself. And then if I have a success with an idea, then I want to share it. You know, I'm never writing for anyone else.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Track 2 Miles, first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
Easy, okay. And the emotion that I experienced was terror. And it was God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols.
Okay.
My dad used to buy The Enemy, and my elder brother Russ used to read it. I was 11 when God Save the Queen came out. My brother was 14, 15. And with his pocket money, my brother bought God Save the Queen 7-inch single, and I'd heard it in his bedroom. I think he'd even, you know, invited me into his bedroom, said, come and listen. Said, no, he hadn't. He hadn't. I hadn't heard. I'd heard it through the wall. And so he went out one afternoon, and I snuck into his bedroom and I found it, and I took it onto my record player in my bedroom, and I put it on. And the excitement of the music was fabulous. And then Lydon's voice came in, and I would liken it to, I thought the gates of hell had been opened and a terrifying demon had entered my room. I'd never heard a voice like it. I was fucking terrified of it. And so much so that it pinned me up the wall, and I desperately wanted to get back to the deck and turn it off. Such was, you know, I'm 11 and I am seriously frightened. And I had to just stay against the wall until it finished and the arm lifted. And I stood there and I thought to myself, that experience was fucking amazing. Let's do it again. It must be the kind of terror that people experience when they go on roller coasters and then, you know, they get addicted to it. Yeah. I had a similar kind of thing with my relationship with riding motorbikes years ago. But it was terror. I was 11 and I was terrified of John Lydon's voice. I honestly thought it was something that had been released from hell, and it was fucking fantastic.
And the cover as well was so stark as well, wasn't it? And it was so, like, you know, as a young boy, that must have just been such a smack round the chops to hear that kind of ferocity and anger and
but
we've such fucking great pop tunes as well, just like really infectious, you know.
Yeah, I mean, melodically it's brilliant, the lyrics are brilliant. When you consider the age that he was when he wrote those lyrics, they're so on point. And it, you know, it's not an abusive a tirade. It's an intellectual introduction to a debate. Mm. And he was, what, 18, 19 when he wrote that?
Crazy.
Which is just, you know, and not college educated or anything. Just phenomenal. The artwork was this... Are they really shredding into the royal family? Yeah. Which I'd had no experience of any kind of media doing that before. Yeah. And then simply on an aesthetic point of view, that I think it was the first record I'd ever seen that when you took it out the sleeve, that the label also had complimentary artwork to the sleeve, whereas everything, I'd got a lot of records by then, but everything was, you know, a label imprint. It was Polydor or Rack or whatever. But so there was so much to that experience of just that beautiful piece of 7-inch, you know, media. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
Brilliant. So you mentioned your older brother. So was you exposed to lots of music growing up? Like was there records on in the house a lot?
Mm-hmm. Well, Dad was a jazz drummer when he was a kid. So there would be a lot of jazz on. He's also a great fan of British classical composers, you know, such as Elgar and the like. So there would be, and he's also a big Bob Dylan fan as well. So that would be kind of what was coming out of the lounge on a Sunday when he fired up his kick-ass stereo and we weren't allowed in there. Also, his brother, my Uncle Bill, had been in a late lineup of The Move and then went on to... Yeah, and he's in the original lineup of Electric Light Orchestra with Roy Wood, and then him and Roy leave that and form Wizard. So my uncle was in Wizard. So, you know, in 1972 when... I don't remember any mention of... I was only six in 1972, but I remember him being on Top of the Pops doing Ballpark Incident and it being on the radio and him giving us, you know, we're off to see the Wizard t-shirts and badges and stickers and stuff like that.
I mean, that's pretty cool, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So my fate was sealed, really, very, you know, under the age of 10 that I was going to be in a band. So, you know, you got a pretty varied taste of music from my dad. The fact that my uncle was a pop star, that my brother was 3.5 years older than me, and so he was a great age to not go to all the gigs that he would have liked to have gone to, but to be aware of the fact that there's a new Clash single out next week, there's a new Roots single out, there's a new Jam single out. And he was pretty generous with letting me borrow his records and the like. And before that, you know, so from the age of six, seeing Uncle Bill on Top of the Pops, getting into Slade, feeling that, you know, I'm from the Midlands, so there's that incredible sense of pride that seemingly the biggest, you know, pop and rock band as opposed to a metal band in the UK were from our neighbourhood, felt pretty special. It was pretty special. So, yeah, I my fate was sealed really very early.
Okay. Well, I want to pick back up on Top of the Pops later because...
Okay.
What we'll do next is while we're... way back then, let's talk. The song reminds you of your time at school.
It's going to be another one from the punk days, and I think I'm going to go for Peaches by the Stranglers, and I think it's got to be a Stranglers track because when I went into senior school at age 11, I didn't get put. It was, you know, it was 1,500 kids in my school, I think, and I'd gone from quite a small primary school. And none of the kids from my class at the primary school, I wasn't placed with any of them in my new tutor group at the senior school. I was in a classroom of 30 strangers. And there was this interesting looking guy with a skinhead and a Harrington jacket and Doc Martens. And we sort of clocked each other at that tender age of 11 and like, okay, me and you are going to be mates. And we're still mates to this day. His name's Nigel Broadbent. And we loved all the punk and new wave records that came out between, you know, that meeting in 1977 and going through school and graduating onto things like Echo and the Bunnymen. But the Stranglers would have been, well, yeah, are his absolute favourite band of that era. And, of course, It has an expletive in it, which there was another version done for radio play. It has the "oh shit" line in it. It has the clitoris word in it, which we, of course, sniggering little idiot 11-year-olds thought was highly amusing and naughty. And it was on the radio. It was in the charts, and the band had a logo you could scribble on all your books. Yeah. And it was a very unusual piece of music. You know, yes, it's a 4/4 rock track, but with led really by a bass riff, a really angry vocal. Not in the way that John Lydon's was terrifying, but this just sounded like a really angry bloke.
Yeah.
And then the beautiful keyboard work of Dave Greenfield, you know, set it aside from so much of the other punk stuff that was around. So I would say it'd be the Stranglers, or it would be something like, you know, Looking After Number One by the Boomtown Rats, which is kind of like the pop end of punk. But I enjoyed that greatly. But so I'm going to go for Peaches by the Stranglers.
Okay, great shout. How was school, Miles? Did you enjoy it?
No. Well, I enjoyed it in so much as it was a social event. I mean, and that's all school was to me. And because there was such a vast amount of kids at my comprehensive school, you could sort of go through those 5 years pretty much unnoticed, which is what I did. I got no qualifications out of it. I didn't pass any exams. I was expelled, actually, a few months before I should have left anyway.
Why's that?
It was claimed that I was the ringleader of an unruly mob.
Yes.
I was in an unruly mob, but I was far from the ringleader. And the school was atrocious. You know, my brother had been expelled from it before I had, for similar, you know, reasons. We had our own personalities. It was mine and my brother's problem to them. And we weren't, we got the academic smarts. We just weren't interested and couldn't see the point, because we were going to be kicked out into Thatcher's Britain where there were no jobs anyway. So fuck it was kind of our attitude. And the most important thing that was happening in society was punk rock and new wave, and they weren't teaching that at school. Yeah. So we had no interest in it. So in terms of seeing mates and making a lifelong friend like Nigel Broadbent, school was great. But putting up with the sort of petty bourgeois control that teachers like to have over you was a vexation and an irritation. But, you know, I got caned and stuff like that. And then, as I said, finally expelled. But, I don't think that as a grown-up I would have suffered for not attending school.
You're a confident kid.
No, I was painfully, painfully shy. I was all right in a mob, which is really, which I think is one of the other, apart from music, it's one of the things that attracted me into being in a band, being in a gang, you know, safety in numbers.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's stay back in around that time. And I want to know what the first record you remember buying from a record shop was.
With my own money, going up to the counter, it was Boots, the chemist, that used to have a record counter in. This would be in Chelmsley Wood on the outskirts of Birmingham. And it was Radar Love by Golden Earring.
I don't know that. Tell me about that.
What?
I don't know it.
Driver. I've been driving all night, my hands wet on the wheel. Down, it's half man. You don't know this?
I don't
my
think
baby
so.
Calling, I need you here. It's I think they're a Danish rock band called Golden Earring. Check it out. I mean, Radar Love is stunning. And it hangs around a sort of bluesy bass line. And then it builds. It has a little bit of a brass section in it. And it builds to this almighty crescendo. There's a drum solo of sorts. And this was a hit single. It had a drum solo in it, for Christ's sakes. And on Top of the Pops, I don't know whether they were at Top of the Pops or it was filmed for a Danish or European TV show, but for the crescendo, the last beat of the final bar, the drummer leapt over the kit and landed on his feet. It was incredible.
Yes.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful track. The extended version I suppose the correct version that's on the album is remarkable. But, I mean, it's a butchered edit for the British singles market, but even that is just utterly brilliant. And I think that at the time as well was when I started to notice production, that that I realized I thought it was the label's fault. I remember thinking at one point everything on CBS sounded tinny and crummy, and everything on EMI sounded rich and expansive. And there might be an element of truth that I haven't gone back and checked, but it might have been to do with which mastering engineers those record companies were using. I mean, things like Give Them Enough Rope by The Clash is such a thin sounding record originally, whereas Tom Robinson Band's Power in the Darkness, which is the same year, it's got loads of low end. It could be to do with the production. I think there's something answerable in the mastering as well. But I mention that because Radar Love had the same sort of, you know, as a four-piece rock band, they had the same sort of setup as Slade, but they just sounded a little bit more expensive. And I think that was me noticing production at a young age.
So at a young age, was you sort of deconstructing records then in your head?
Yeah. It's a curse, really, because it's how I still listen to music. You know, people will often, you know, either be at my house or we'll be out somewhere where we're able to play music. Like, Milo, listen to this. Tell me what you think of this. And I'm listening to like the compression on the bass drum for the first 45 seconds and have completely missed what might have been an amazing vocal intro or a great chordal shift into a bridge or a chorus, because I'm thinking, nah, hate the compression on the kick drum. It's a curse. Yeah, it's fucking horrible.
All right. Well, you mentioned Top of the Pops again whilst talking about them. So I'm going to ask you, for someone that grew up, seeing, you know, an uncle on there, and like, I guess, most, you know, young people, it was an institution every week, you know, it was where you got to see your pop stars, you know, you got to, you know, hear records that, you know, a lot of the time you couldn't afford. How was it for you? I always ask people that have been on here, that have been on Top of the Pops, how that experience was getting on Top of the Pops, and did it deliver what you thought it was going to deliver?
Well, none of us wanted to do it. I think me and... Well, because The Clash had never done it.
Yeah.
And if you were going to do it, it was great pre-punk, for all the reasons you just said. To be able to see David Bowie on a Thursday night in your own home was incredible. And Mark Bolan. But by the time punk came along, it was year zero. It had ripped up the previous rule book. And those were the new set of rules that I stuck with. And so The Clash had never done it. The Pistols, I think they showed a video that The Pistols had made for themselves. I think Pretty Vacant was on there. There may have been other Pistols appearances. I doubt it, though, actually. But Pretty Vacant was on there, and of course I enjoyed seeing that. But they weren't in the studio, and apparently The Clash were asked to be on there a bunch of times, or invited, and they always turned it down, thinking, I guess they thought it was below them. I don't know. I could research this and see what their thoughts were on it at the time. But anyway, they never did it. And then, of course, The Jam did it at every opportunity, and I adored The Jam. But for some reason, this idea of The Clash stuck with me. And Public Image Limited did it.
Def Disco. Amazing.
And that was a stunning performance. You know, you got Joel Wobble sitting on a bar stool with a pair of earphones around his neck.
And a black tattoo.
That's right. Yeah. See, this is how it does affect you when you're young. And I just thought, and I think the bass thing, you know, the original bass player in The Wonder Stuff, Rob Jones, I think he was probably, I think Martin and Malk would have looked forward to it. And if I hadn't have been so militant about it, they might have even enjoyed themselves. But I made sure nobody fucking enjoyed themselves because I absolutely didn't want to do it. And we were made to do it, basically, because by which time we'd already toured America. And to tour America, we needed a shitload of cash from our record company, Polydor. You know, they called it tour support. So, and I'm talking like 40 grand, to take the four-piece band and probably four, maybe five crew, hire a tour bus and drive around America for 6 or 7 weeks. When the gigs, in those early days, they're not paying for the tours, not even close to breaking even. So the label picked up the shortfall. Now, when I'm sitting there having done that and had the time of my life and can't wait to go back, then Top of the Pops comes along, because we didn't get invited on there until Hop, our second album. And the first song we did on there was Don't Let Me Down Gently. It was spelled out to me that, well, if you want to keep going on these American jaunts that you enjoy so much, you've got to give us something back. You know, we've got to get that money back. And in the UK, love it or hate it, the best way of getting into as many homes as you possibly can is Top of the Pops. So, you know, strap your little suit on, get on the fucking stage and do your miming. And but I made sure that I hated it. You know, it could have been... we did it six, maybe seven times.
It could have been fun, Miles.
It could have been. But I'd already gone making sure that there was no fucking way on earth was I or anyone with me going to enjoy this. So, yeah, we had to do it every time we were invited on. The final time was for Hot Love Now.
Yeah.
And that one I said, absolutely not. Just fucking, but I knew I was leaving the band at the end of that album period anyway. So I went missing. I just fucked off. And no, I didn't tell anyone. I told my wife at the time where I was, so she wasn't worried. But I didn't tell the rest of the band, and I didn't tell the manager. And the band were fine with it. The band knew I was going to go. They knew I was going to disappear, but they didn't know where. But my manager didn't. And it was a cruel thing to do to him, because he had to take all the flack from Polydor. But I just said, I ain't fucking doing it. I told you I ain't doing it. And eventually I didn't.
I asked you if you was a confident kid at school. And I've seen the one stuff many, many times. I've seen Vent. And you look like a confident kid on stage. Did as a CRAD member, that's how it comes across. Did you grow in confidence, or, you know, is it something that you have to sort of try and switch on when you go on stage? How do you, you know, how's that confidence with gigs and stuff?
It's an act. I mean, from the beginning, from the early days, it's an act. Simple as that. I just became a different character to go on stage with, and I was given the confidence to do that by being in this little gang. You know, the other three guys that I was on stage with, the crew that traveled with us and you know, made everything happen. There's big personalities in the Wonder stuff. You know, Rob Jones was an incredible personality, and Martin and Malk were pretty confident. You know, Malk sort of quieter and more genteel, but still confident. And in those days, you know, when you were gigging around the UK in 86 and 87, there was also something beyond the music that you had to consider. Like, can you handle yourself? And Malk and Bob could certainly handle themselves physically, you know. We got run out of towns by the police. We got run out of towns by, you know, security at universities that was essentially the rugby team that wanted to beat the shit out of us because we got ripped jeans and long hair. So I got a certain confidence from being in a gang, but the gobshite on stage, who I know was completely over the top, I could have tempered it a little bit. but I just went with, let's go completely over the fucking top and tell the audience that they're cunts before we've even struck a note. Over the years, it tempered. And also over the years, that invented confident Miles Hunt, actually, I became him unpleasantly for a number of years. And then I've sort of got the balance about right. But I still have bouts of shyness in, you know, I was the other night, I was in a neighbor's garden. Two of them I know really well, two or three of the other people I don't know so well. And I retreat back into shyness, because the things that I can talk about with confidence are not sort of dinner party conversations with regular people that have actually worked for a living.
Sure.
You know, me telling road stories of getting busted for pot in New Orleans isn't the sort of thing that you can bring up. You know, I just think, fucking hell, what's he on about? So I just sort of go quiet and retreat. So, yeah, I can switch between. I think the factory settings me is shy and with very little confidence.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you now for track 5, Miles, a song that soundtrack your years clubbing.
You assume that I was a clubber.
Well, when I say that, that doesn't necessarily mean kind of like, you know, chrome-laced discotheques of the of the early 80s. It can be dirty, sweaty rock and indie clubs.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. So I did get it. So this would be, I'm going back to where, you know, from around about 16, 17 years of age, I'm able to get into Birmingham nightclubs, indie, I suppose we called them alternative nightclubs at the time, that were, you know, the origins of goth, I suppose. And this was one out of two tracks, really, that would guarantee me heading for the dance floor. I've gone with The Cult's She Sells Sanctuary, which I still think is an utterly remarkable piece of work that I still don't really understand it. I know it has an A part and a B part, and then it has a break, and then there's a sort of a C part, which is made of the A part. So I can kind of understand it, you know, and I've been in a band with Billy Duffy, and Billy Duffy showed me how to play it. And it's just a very unusual song in its construction. I still wouldn't know whether Asprey's doing a verse and a chorus, or is it just a collection of hooks that he knows where to put them to use them to their best advantage. And then you got Mark Brzenki, who playing the drums on that, who had been or was in and continued to be in, and I think perhaps even still is, in Big Country. And he's a wonderfully, you know, he knows what he's doing. And they must have had a conversation that, like, we're making this track for the dance floor. Whereas, you know, a couple of albums after that, they're making tracks to go into that vein of sort of early AC/DC and stuff.
Yeah.
That this is for a harder crowd. I think they knew they were going for a dance floor track when they worked on Sanctuary. And I just think it's incredibly unusual. It's a beautiful track to be halfway drunk to and spin around and lose all your inhibitions and keep trying to make everyone else on the dance floor believe that you know what the lyrics are, when in fact, having been listening to it for 30 years, I still don't know what they are. Just like, in a world.
What a fucking intro as well.
Oh, God. I mean, exactly. And there was that, you know, you could be standing at the bar or sitting around on a group, you know, at a table with a group of friends, and the DJ would just drop that.
Have you got enough time to get there before the snare?
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's pints would hit the fucking table and you'd all be off to the floor. And you're right. As soon as that snare, blap! And there's an awful lot of hair swinging around. It's just gorgeous.
Do you know what, Miles? I've been playing it in my club for probably 30 years and it sounds as fresh now as it ever did. It hasn't aged in the slightest. It sounds as vital, as fucking huge. It's a perfect record.
Yeah, and it is. I think it's like I was saying, you know, like Mark Brzenki, the drummer, is a beautifully technical drummer, but he just fucking plays it straight, like it's a dance track.
Yeah,
he plays it incredibly straight, apart from that gorgeous fill after the middle eight drop down. But which I still probably, when I'm programming drums on new songs, I still use that fill in everything that I do. So he plays it straight, and it's, you know, it's that clicky, it's got the click on the front of the kick drum, and it's got the on the end of the drum as well. And it's just, I'm not surprised you're still playing it in clubs. And I think if I could ever be tempted into a danceteria or a discotheque and I heard it, I think I would have exactly the same reaction when I hear those opening chords. I would have to run to the dance floor.
Wonderful. Track 6, Miles. Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
Okay, well, I did... The Wonder Stuff did an album probably 7 or 8 years ago now of cover versions of artists from the Midlands, and we called it From the Midlands with Love. So we cover Duran Duran and The Beat, UB40. We miss out like Zeppelin and Sabbath because those bands didn't really touch me when I was younger. We cover Slade, and we had the absolute audacity to take on Dex's Midnight Runners. And I should really say in the answer to, you know, the favourite song from an artist from my home county should be Blackberry Way by the move because it's extraordinary in every sense. Yeah, and I perhaps really should pick a Slade track, but I wanted to go with just something a little less obvious. And so I've gone for There, There, My Dear by Dexys Midnight Runners. Now, I will make the claim that Searching for the Young Soul Rebels, the debut album by Dexys Midnight Runners, is the greatest debut album by anybody. It is fucking perfect. Again, right? So it opens with Dance Dance, or is on the album, is it called Burn It Down? It's the same song, but there's two different titles they use. And it starts with the radio being tuned in, which I think was probably an influence to us for the beginning of Hop.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear a little bit of, it's either God Save the Queen or Anarchy in the UK, and another couple of tracks of the era. And then Kevin Rowland comes in with, For God's Sake, Burn It Down. Ba, 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 ba. And from that moment on, however, the next many minutes, 38, 42 minutes, it's just, it's untouchable. Production-wise, it is beautiful, it is clear, it is powerful. having that big brass section, you know, they were coming out at the same time. You know, we very much thought of them as a new wave punk band, you know. But its heart was in soul music. And Kevin's vocal delivery on every track is, it's just beautiful, and it's unsurpassable. And we took on doing a version of There, There, My Dear, and it's a pretty straight, you know, using their arrangement. But I had to, well, what I'm going to end up saying is once I'd learned the lyrics and I'm doing the vocal takes, I cried several times whilst doing it. Whilst actually singing it, and you had to stop and take a breath just because there's so much emotion required to deliver that lyric. And so for that reason, I'm going to choose it, because I suppose I could have used that as the, you know, when you said the first song you remember hearing that produced an emotion, but I don't think I fully understood the genius of There, There, My Dear until we deconstructed it and tried to do our own version of it. It's just so intense. It's remarkable.
It's a truly remarkable album.
Yeah.
It's your last track, Miles.
Mm-hmm.
And you can play DJ now.
Okay.
And it's a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
Okay. Well, it's a really interesting, it's a great question to ask. I don't think I've ever been asked that question. And it's also, there's a certain synchronicity to being asked that question at this point in time. For years, I have loved the song These Days, written by Jackson Brown. Now, I didn't know it when it came out in the 70s. And I think the very first version I heard of it wasn't by Jackson Brown. I think the very first version I heard of it was around about 1997, 1998. And the song was being covered by, it's a studio project that is managed by a great producer and drummer called Anton Fia. And they call themselves the Golden Palominos, and they use various artists. So, you know, Jack Bruce has played with them. Nicky Skopelitis, Knox Chandler, John Lydon's song on it, Nicole Blackman. And it's guest musicians and guest vocalists, but Anton Fear is holding the whole thing together as a drummer and producing it. And there are some truly remarkable, and most of it is original songs. You know, they all write the songs, but on the, I think it's the second Golden Palominos album, they do a cover of Jackson Brown's These Days. And I suppose it's quite Beatles-esque in it's this beautiful descending chord structure, but it just has just fucking heartbreaking lyrics, which I think I've got. Have I got the lyrics up on a computer yet? They were the other day. All right, okay. I've got the lyrics up because I've finally done a cover version of it in recent weeks. And it's this last line that is just, it's just insane. It goes, "Don't confront me with my failures. I have not forgotten them." Which, obviously, in context of the song, it's incredibly powerful. But as a last line, "Don't confront me with my failures. I have not forgotten them." I just think it's so beautifully tragic. Yeah. And so Nico from that we know from the Velvet Underground, she did a cover version of it, probably sometime in the 70s, which has got a really lovely string arrangement on it. So I think I've got four or five different versions by different artists. And when I was working with a guy called Andres Carew and Michael Ferentino, a couple of friends of mine out in New Jersey in the States, I had a band with them rather egotistically called the Miles Hunt Club in the in the early 2000s. And I co-wrote with Michael. We did an album called the Miles Hunt Club. It's mostly songs that I've written, but I co-wrote a couple with Michael, and we also did a song of Michael's that he'd already released with his own band, The Amazing Meat Project, a song called Love Will Make You Sorry. And it's a ballad that's not the sort of thing you would expect me to sing. I always said to Michael, who is a Prince fan, I always said to him, I can just hear Prince doing this. Prince would have fucking killed this tune. Anyway, so I had a crack at it. But when I went over to the States to record the album, on my list of things to do on this album was in 2000, this was 20 years ago, was to tackle a version of These Days by Jackson Brown, which is a ballad, really, you know. But because we'd done Michael's Love Can Make You Sorry, I didn't want to go and put another ballad on the song. So we didn't even get around to trying These Days. But during the lockdown, the producer of that album and drummer and bass player, as it was as well, Andres Carew, he said to me early on in lockdown, you know, you got your studio. So he's in Queens in New York, and he's like, I'm bored out of my head. Do you want to just do some tracks? Let's just do some fun cover versions together. So we did, he suggested Doctor My Eyes, which I only knew by the Jackson 5, but it's a Jackson Brown song as well. And I said, okay, if we're going to do Jackson Brown song, can we finally get around to doing These Days? And this week he's just sent me a final mix of it, and it's sweet. And we got Michael Ferentino playing guitar in it. So it's like the missing track from the album that we recorded 20 years ago. We've actually finally got round and done this year. If you don't know it, look it up. It's beautiful. Go with the Jackson Brown version. Then I would go with the Nico version. And then see if you can find that Golden Palominos version. And then at some point later this year, I'm sure we'll release our version. But lyrically, it's beautiful. You know, I've written three books now. The book's called The Wonder Stuff Diaries, which are, you know, my autobiographies, as it were. And I was going to, you know, when people like do dedications at the beginning of books, I just wanted to put all of the lyrics to These Days to the final one, because the three books that I've done, the third one's kind of like the saddest and most depressing of the three books. And I just thought that final line, you know, don't confront me with my failings, I have not forgotten them, would have summed up that whole book. Those two lines, I could have saved all my time, not written a book, and just go, this is how I feel about this period of my life. So yeah, These Days by Jackson Brown.
Wonderful. Before we wrap things up, Miles, as we start to see ourselves coming out of the lockdown scenario we find ourselves in, what's kind of coming up? What's the sort of the first things you're going to do? You're going to try and get back out and play as soon as you can?
No. My parents are 80 in September, and they have underlying health conditions I have to consider. They live about 7 miles away from where I live. I like to see them every week. So, no, it is not my intention to get out and gig as soon as we can. And I think I don't think anybody's going to be able to do that, to be quite honest. No. It's not looking good. I was talking to a great friend of mine in San Francisco last night, who's a touring sound engineer, has been for 40 years. And I'm like, Frank, can you see any chinks of light? And he's like, Milo, my friend, no, I ain't seeing anything. You know, we've seen some great venues of the grassroots venues in this country getting their ass kicked this week. We are going to, you know, potentially, I mean, it's terrible, absolutely appalling for the people that own and work at those venues, appalling for all the young bands that are now out there learning their chops. You know, the greats, yeah, whether it's Johnny Lydon or David Bowie, they all learned their chops playing clubs and small venues. That's why they were so fucking brilliant by the time we got to see them. And so young people that are, you know, that have that plan for their life These venues are being stripped away. We're potentially being robbed for years to come of the great talent that we deserve, and that the UK is historically fucking brilliant at producing. It's really worrying times.
Miles, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Stuart. I really enjoyed myself.
There you go. What an episode. What a top fella. Miles Hunt, huge thanks to Miles for giving up his time to do that. Massive thanks to you for listening. Really appreciate the fact that you listen, support, and I've seen you all retweeting and sharing and recommending. So it's so kind of you to do that. I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, like I say, if you're new to this podcast, this was the first one you've listened to, go and have a route around in the back catalogue, because you're going to find loads of stuff that you're going to enjoy if you enjoyed this. I'm back next week. In the meantime, stay safe, be nice, and yeah, see you soon. Bye bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast, and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.